Please join in with me. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. So that's a Metta Sutta. We chant that very often, sometimes in the Pali, but also in the English as well. The English can sometimes give it more meaning, and meaning which we can understand. And it's also some of those words that can be very profound and deep. When I was giving a retreat, actually I gave two retreats, almost one after the other, in Jhana Grove recently, I did make the point that sometimes people complain if something is too easy to understand, they think it cannot be profound. And I remember just many times as a lay person, as a layman, a student, going to some of these talks by these professors. This was in UK. And afterwards, we'd say, oh, that was so profound. Yes, that was really profound. Did you understand any of it? No, we didn't. That's why it was very profound. And so obviously that means it's meaningless. And it's only later on that you realize if somebody knows what they're talking about and they explain it well, then everybody can understand it. And that was really important to know, that just because you understand it does not mean it's not deep. That Metta Sutta is very, very deep. They have some sayings in there which are just really quite moving. It's just like, let them be contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. And I often focus on that in meditation talks. Let them be contented. The idea of contentment is a very, very beautiful word. It means you're happy sitting here listening to this talk. There may be other things you have to do in life, but in order to be still, to be focused, to be actually be here, we learn to develop this contentment. You know, sometimes you think, what other place could you be on a Tuesday evening? Now you are listening to a talk from a monk, you are safe, content. So that contentment becomes a very, very beautiful experience, and easily satisfied, which means you don't need much in your life to have this contentment. And of course, many of you have visited Bodhinyana Monastery, from which I'm talking. I like to actually to encourage people to have a look inside where I live, my cave, as long as I'm not there at the time, because I don't want you knocking on the door disturbing me all day, all times of day and night. But when I'm away, please go and have a look inside my cave. It is a cave that's very simple. You don't need very much, you know, to be a content monk. And you're easily satisfied, which means you don't have to get so much to have that contentment. And that means you don't have much work to do in life. Yeah, I do other types of work, like talking to people and solving problems and stuff, and teaching retreats, but not the type of work which says, oh, I need something more, I need to get something extra. Because that type of thinking just leads you to so much busyness in life. And the job when we're meditating is not to be busy, not to try and get things, but to be content and easily satisfied. Just to really appreciate what we already have. You've got a body, you've got a mind, you may have some sicknesses, but you've got a life. And it could be much worse. And sometimes, I don't know in your life, but sometimes in my life, you've had tragedies, you've had sicknesses. And one of those, you might call it, big tragedy many years ago was when we had a big bushfire, you know, through Bodhinyana Monastery. It was a crown fire. You can't get much worse than that. And the trees were exploding. And I recall afterwards, you know, having to evacuate the whole property because it was really life-threatening. And seeing all the trees like explode, go boom. And I really thought that was going to be the end of Bodhinyana Monastery. I couldn't imagine, with such a hot fire, with trees exploding, that I couldn't imagine that those huts would survive. But in the following morning, when I went up there, the chief fire officer went up there with me, and I was so surprised to see all these shining corrugated iron roofs, like gleaming in the sunshine of the early morning. They'd all survived. The damage was minimal. And that was kind of like a miracle. But at the same time, I thought, you're content and easily satisfied. It was worth doing. It's worth building that monastery, even if it was all destroyed. And I built it again. And I always remember that feeling. Then it doesn't matter what you do in your life. Sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not. It doesn't really matter if it's successful. We do it because it needs to be done. If it works, wonderful. If it doesn't work, we learn how to work again and make it work next time. So this is that contentment, easily satisfied, not demanding much in nature, which means that we can have that beautiful contentment. And that's also in meditation as well. So in our meditation, some of the things we learn to do is learn how to give. I often do this when I meditate. I say, I give the next half an hour to someone I really care about. Often my teacher, you know, Ajahn Chah, or to the Buddha, whatever I imagine that Buddha to be. I give this half an hour just as a nice gift of peace, you know, to the person I respect. When you do that, it's not trying to get something out of the meditation, but what you can give to it, to give some peace, you know, into your house, into your home, into your community, give some peace into your own body. It becomes very beautiful when we meditate in order to give. We're not proud, we're not demanding, and we're very easily satisfied. You may not get the reward this time, but you can't always get rewards every day. It reminded me of that story, which I'm sure many of you have heard, but I'm not sure that some of you are getting older. And I mentioned I like talking Dhamma to those people who are getting old, because I can tell the same old stories again and again and again. You can't remember that I told them last time. But anyway, that's the story of the migrant who came to Australia. And the migrant who came to Australia, you know, he was a doctor in his home country, but his qualifications weren't recognised. So because of that, he could get a job. He had to get a job anyway. He got a job on a building site. And then job on a building site, he worked really hard the first day. And when he got home, his wife said, "How much did you earn today?" He said, "Nothing. I worked really hard, but the boss never paid me, not even a cent." He worked there on Tuesday and Wednesday, and the same thing happened. "I earned nothing." And he was complaining. People in Australia, they just exploit migrants. It's not fair. He worked all that hard work for nothing. But then he went to work again on Thursday. The same thing happened, didn't get anything. And on Friday, his wife said, "Well, you know, you might as well go. They've got nothing else to do." So he worked really hard on Friday. So actually, not so hard on Friday. On Friday afternoon, the boss called him into the office and gave him a big pay packet, and then sent him home. "See you on Monday." And he went home to his wife and said, "I have finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays." Payday. And of course, you all know, it's really difficult when you just watch people on the screen. You can't distinguish between a groan and a laugh. I think it's more groans than laughs. But nevertheless, you can't expect to get paid every day when you go to work. Those days you don't get paid is where you build up your credit until you finally get the payday, which has to come. And that's one of the reasons why when we give to our meditation, instead of expecting to get, when payday comes, it's a wonderful, beautiful surprise. We have a lot of peace, a lot of happiness, and some amazing things happen in our life, in our body, even in our families. I often say this when people go on retreats. You may go on a retreat and think you're just taking time out from your family and from your duties, but the truth of the matter is that your family are so happy when you come back. It's like sending your car into the garage to get tuned up, to get all the bugs out of the system. And when you go home, you're a much better person to live with. And I don't know exactly if you remember all those stories, but one of those stories was actually a lady who used to go to the Armidale group when we held it in the Armidale hospital. And she told me, she said, "I never wanted to come this evening to the Tuesday evening meditation. I was came home from work, I was tired. I'd rather just, you know, have something to eat, have a cup of coffee and sit in front of the TV and just watch something." And She said her children asked her, "Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight?" "No, darling, I feel too tired." "Mummy, you must go to meditation tonight." "But I don't feel like it." "Mummy, you must go to meditation tonight." "Why, children?" "Because you're a much nicer mummy after you come home from meditation." The children get to know that, and the people you live with get to know that, and even your cats and dogs get to know that. Whoever you live with, you become a much better person when you just have a little meditation, let alone a whole retreat. Even many years ago, when I was visiting Thailand, I was flying from one place to another, and on the flight, you know, nothing much to do, I looked at a copy of the Bangkok Post, the English newspaper in Thailand. And there's a big article in there about this hotel called the Oriental Hotel. It's quite an old hotel and very famous. But apparently that year they had won the Best Hotel in the World award. And so they interviewed the manager. "How come you got this Best Hotel in the World award? What do you do which is different?" And the manager of the hotel said, "What I do is every employee of this hotel, whether it's the cooks, the waiters, the cleaners, or the people on the front desk booking people in, every person in this hotel, I, on a roster system, not all at the same time, I send to a monastery for a week's meditation, all paid for by the hotel, not sort of taken off their vacations. I send them to this monastery just to do some meditation, just for 1 week, 7 days. And they come back and they're just so much more relaxed, so much more harmonious, both with each other and with our clients, our guests. The food is much better in the kitchen. The waiters are more kind to, you know, the guests. It was just a positive for everybody. So he said, "I don't mind paying for this." You know, the whole hotel sponsors 7-day retreat for every one of the staff. And I thought that's a very good idea. I don't know where you work or for, you know, what agency or company or whatever you work. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if you could ask, I don't know who you work for, like Telstra or the government as a doctor or as a nurse or as a bus driver or as a cook, whoever you are, to ask your boss at work, "Can we please have 7 days in Bodhinyana Monastery or Jhana Grove for a meditation retreat, because you'll be a much better worker?" And you would be. You'd be healthier too. And so sometimes the benefits of this meditation practice were just made very clear by this award that this hotel got. It cost them money to send everybody there, but they certainly got their money back with interest, because everybody was far happier at work and also more peaceful. So there's so many benefits when one knows how to meditate properly. But also I must say that on those retreats, very often that people think that a retreat you have to put so much energy in and effort, that you have to strive. No pain, no gain. And just how wrong that all is. As I learned meditation when I was very young, meditation is not striving, but it's learning how to relax. Relax very deeply. To relax your body and relax your mind. And it's from that you get what we call not the concentration, but the stillness. And this is where sometimes people mistake. The goal of meditation is not to learn how to concentrate and to focus. It's just to learn how to be still. And when the mind is very still, it acts like, they call it a still forest pool. The water is not moving. So you can sit right next to that still forest pool, and especially at night time, you can see a perfect clear reflection of the moon and the stars in the heavens above. If there's any ripples in that lake, you can't see the clear reflection. The truth becomes distorted when the mind isn't still. But it's not just seeing the truth of things, but just seeing how beautiful these things can be. It was a weird truth of meditation. The more still you become, the more peaceful, then the more joyful it becomes, the happier it becomes. That's one of the reasons why I often say, as a monk, you know, you can become a very happy person. That's probably our best advertising campaign for coming on retreats. It is the smile. And this is like a natural smile, because you have happiness when you become still and peaceful. So this is one of the reasons why. Never call it concentration. Concentration tires you out and makes you look sort of quite ugly, actually. But the stillness makes it very peaceful and very happy and very deep, easily. And of course, you all know that's why I never call a meditation retreat center, I never call the Armidale Meditation Group about concentration. The joke is that otherwise it becomes a concentration camp. And that's the last thing we want, to sort of have a psychological connection with that sort of stuff. And instead, I always call any meditation retreat, I call it in Jhana Grove, I used to call it in the Armidale Meditation Group. I never used to call it Armidale Meditation Group. I used to call it Club Med Armidale. And it's much more truthful than if it was some sort of resort where you eat too much and you play all sorts of competitive games and you spend a lot of money. The real Club Med is Club Meditation. And you get far more peace and happiness and benefits from a holiday like that. You know, when people come to our meditation retreats, they just, sometimes they go home. And the people they work with, they say, "Where have you been?" They said, "I've been on a meditation retreat." And I say, "What? You know, only eating in the morning time, sitting long hours, you know, not being able to watch a TV or anything. That must be so hard." So these days, to make it easier for people to understand, they don't say they've been on a meditation retreat. They say they've been in Club Med. Club Med Serpentine. And it gets people more interested in what's really going on. And the happiness and the peace and the stillness, the health and the wisdom. So those are, you know, some of the stuff which comes up. Please, when you are meditating in a few minutes, please make sure it's not to get something, to get something which you think you're missing. It's actually learning how to be here, learning how to be content, easily satisfied, not having an ego and wanting things, not being proud, but being easily satisfied, content, and not demanding in nature. Don't demand anything out of the meditation, otherwise you won't get anything. Except suffering. Just learn how to be at peace with this moment, with all any difficulties, any problems, any sicknesses you have. You'll find that when you don't ask for anything, you get everything in the whole world. One of those best meditation similes. Many of you have heard this before, just testing your memories. About the donkey and the carrot. How do you get a donkey to pull a cart? You may hit it with a stick. We have a phrase in English, to be as stubborn as a donkey. If you hit the donkey with a stick, it won't move. Instead, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. The front of the stick is maybe 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot. And that donkey sees the carrot just 2 feet in front of its head. And of course the donkey will move towards the carrot. And as the donkey moves, so does the stick, so does the string, so does the carrot. So the carrot's always a couple of feet in front of the donkey's head. And that's how they get the donkey to move whatever's tied behind the donkey, the cart or the people or whatever. But of course, you very rarely see donkey carts these days. And the reason is because of Buddhism and meditation, the donkeys have learned how to catch the carrot. It's so easy when you think about it. The donkey runs really fast after the carrot, really fast. And the carrot is still 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth. But then what does the donkey do? The donkey stops. That's what we do in meditation, we stop. We don't go running after things, we stop. And the carrot is in front of the donkey's head, it moves further away from the donkey. And the carrot moves further away than it's ever been before, 4 feet in front of the donkey's mouth. But then something strange happens. Then the carrot starts swinging towards the donkey. And soon the carrot's in its usual place, 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth. But it's still moving fast, very fast, towards the donkey's mouth. And soon it comes so close to the donkey's mouth, the donkey has to remember the last piece of instruction. It's not just stopping and being still and meditating, it's being kind. You must always remember the kindness. The donkey says to that carrot as it comes really close, "Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. Come in." And that's how the donkey catches the carrot, his kindfulness. Otherwise it bangs against the teeth and breaks a few teeth and body falls out. So that's actually how we catch the carrots, being very still and kind, and then the carrot comes towards us. That's what it means. Don't be proud and demanding in nature. Be content and easily satisfied. Then you can catch so many carrots. If you don't like carrots, you can put something else on the string. I don't know what you're searching for in life. A mango, a banana, whatever. But that's how you catch the carrots. So that's a little introduction on kindness and meditation. Don't ask for anything, just let things come to you. Stop and allow the beauty of stillness to grow the Dhamma, the teachings, the truth inside of you. Okay, so that's 7:30, and I believe that now is the opportunity to do a guided meditation. Is that correct?
It's most definitely correct, Ajahn. Over to you.
Okay, here we go. So, please, first of all, get yourself nice and comfortable in your chair, in your on the floor, or wherever you actually are. You can meditate anywhere, remember. Even if you're sick, you meditate on a bed. If you're dead, you can meditate in a coffin. Why not? That'll shake people up. Okay, so here we go. So once you think you're comfortable, you can close your eyes. And with your eyes closed, the first thing to do is, it's not just to establish mindfulness, it's to be kind to your body. Very often that people, they rush into meditation so fast that the preliminary, necessary essentials they forget. And the first thing is to make your body comfortable. So that's one of the reasons, if you did need to go to the toilet, you still need to go, then please just go now and come and sit back later on. But you want to make sure you're comfy. So I look at my body sitting in this chair and I try to make it comfortable. However, I know that that is superficial. I've got to go much deeper than this. So I start with my feet. I ask these parts of my body, starting with my feet, Are you comfortable? Can I make you more at ease? And I'm willing to just experiment, push my feet apart, push them further away, move them closer into the chair, until I can experience the optimum position for my feet. To do this, I'm mindful, and I also know the feedback which mindfulness can give me. When I do something, I can tell pretty quickly whether it's a better position or a worse position. And I've used that extensively to like heal my body if there's been any injury or any sickness. And it's a very wonderful way. If you do have a cold, or I think it might be a COVID, you can actually go to that part of the body which is uncomfortable. And after a while, a bit of trial and error, you know how to ease that part of the body. Bring it some peace and some healing, some natural healing. I trust my body. I just need to ask it a question. Feet, do you want to be moved? And I trust the answer and act accordingly. So I'm still just adjusting my feet. And I really enjoy taking socks off when I meditate so I can feel the ground underneath my feet. The carpet in the room where I'm giving this meditation instruction, it's an old carpet. It has a very interesting feel. It's fascinating. Your mindfulness starts to pick up some textures which, if you're wearing shoes or you're not mindful, you just miss. So make sure my feet are really at ease. Sometimes I use some imagination, like imagining my feet being bathed in warm, clean water. And any aches or pains or injuries being soaked away. So it feels good. And I don't rush this, because I know that when those feet have a certain sensation, a certain feeling, it's a sensation I recognize as relaxation. So my feet feel at ease. And only then do I go to the next part of my body, here of course, the ankles. Because I'm going to relax the whole of my body, and then after relaxing my body, relaxing the mind. And it becomes very powerful. So I go up to my ankles. Sometimes you may think you can't feel anything there, but just keep on looking there, and after a while you become sensitive to the feelings in your ankles. It seems a combination at the moment in my ankles of some warmth and some coolness coming up from the feet. But I can feel that. Not afraid of it. I'm content with it. Be contented and easily satisfied, not demanding anything, but relaxing the muscles, the bones, and goodness knows what else is in the ankles. Until they too, like my feet, feel so relaxed. You know, sometimes if you're working with a group of people or even with just your family members, just after a while, you become very skillful in everyone being relaxed around you. It's the same I do with my muscles in my ankles and my feet. And then I go up my legs, the calves first of all, the muscles in the calves, the bones in front, blood vessels, skin, making sure as I scan upwards through my calves, that everything is first of all acknowledged. Because sometimes, you know, if you're in a group of people and you never cause any trouble, sometimes people just pass you over. You're not giving the recognition you deserve because you're not causing any problems. I recognize every part of the calves of my legs. Sometimes I linger there. Give every part this beautiful sense of peace and at ease and safety, so nothing feels afraid, nothing feels neglected. Till I get to my knees. Like everybody, you know, you've had falls, I've fallen off ladders a couple of times, had injuries playing sport when I was young, even injuries falling off motorbikes later on. But then, you know how to heal your knees. I just focus on them, pick up any sensations in my knees. How do you feel, knees? Is there anything you need? And just that kindness, the kindness and recognition, mean my knees just, they do relax. They feel content. They kind of tingle with this experience of relaxation, which I've come to know very well. And just that relaxation, that acknowledgement, often just makes everything in that area relax to the max and settle, become really comfortable. It has this little tingle to it, which tells me this relaxation has happened there. And then from the knees, I go up my thighs, big muscles, and also the bones and the skin all around there. I'm making sure everything feels at ease. And if I need to adjust the posture, I will do now. I'm not going to just stick to a posture which I got at the beginning when I wasn't so mindful. I'm kind. And then those muscles in the thighs and the skin and the bones, they all feel at ease. As I go up to the butt, the big buttocks, and I always notice there's a very easy feeling to be aware of. It's the pressure on those buttocks squashed against the chair or the cushion. I can feel that. But I just make sure that there's no folds of my robe, you know, cutting into that skin, that everything is pretty as comfortable as it can be. Because I notice that that feeling, because it doesn't change, it disappears. And after a minute or two, that butt feeling just disappears. And then from the butt, I go to my waist. And the waist, you know, it feels comfortable if my back is in a good position. So it's always at this point that I just stretch my back. That's doing something, that's using a bit of striving. But I only do that for a few seconds and then I let go. I let my body relax. That stretch gives me this boost of, was it endorphins or endomorphins, whatever it's called. And that really feels good and it just helps relax my back and make sure my back is in a good posture. Sometimes I prefer to lean back on my back. Sometimes to sit up straight. Today it's very much a sit up straight back is required. That's what my back tells me. And it feels good. I'm not having a particular posture because that's what it says in the book. I feel it out for myself. And then of course I make sure I go to the bottom of the torso, to the waist again, and then just scan the body upwards. Being a monk, I scan up first of all through the digestive tracts. I say that being a monk because sometimes our eating habits are a bit strange. We have to only eat in the morning time. I've got to make sure that everything is at ease there. And if I find any part of my colon or intestines are a bit tight, I just stay there and relax everything. Use mindfulness and you even just I don't know what to say, it's just trial and error, how to relax things. Sometimes you're not doing anything, but you're just using your mind to ease some of the tightnesses there. And I can feel it relaxing. It might be imagination, I don't know, but it works. That's what I'm really concerned about. And then up you go through your digestive tracts until you get to your stomach, get to your lungs, get to all these organs in your back, everything else which is in this torso. It's a very complex bag of organs, to your heart. And as I scan upwards through my body, I give this beautiful relaxation and kindness and softness wherever I go. So the whole body just appreciates being noticed and receiving kindness. And so everything relaxes. And then I get up to my shoulders. And my shoulders, people often get shoulder massages because their shoulders get tense. I kind of learn how to relax those shoulders. I can feel both those shoulders, the muscles of the shoulders on the left and the right of my body. And I imagine they're being pulled apart, stretched, put under stress. I imagine letting go of each end of those bundles of muscles. I've imagined that so long now, so many years, that just when I do that imaginary exercise, the shoulder muscles loosen up. They're not kind of pulled apart so much. They feel relaxed. I notice when things are relaxed that something might drop on them or hit them and it doesn't hurt at all. You have what's called resilience. When things are loose, nothing really hurts them. And I go down from the shoulder muscles, down the arms. I never had too many problems with my arms and elbows and forearms and wrists. But nevertheless, I just sweep down the body on both sides, down the arms, the elbows, just checking to make sure that everything is at ease there. Just practicing kindfulness on my own body. And I get to the wrists, got to be careful there because they're very easily injured and they can get weak or sore. And then from the wrists to the hands and to the fingers. When I go to my fingers, it's just a case in point that as soon as I'm aware of those fingers, almost every time I start meditating, I realize the fingers are not in a good position. But I forget about that, and the next time I meditate, put them in the wrong position to begin with again. But now, when I'm aware of those fingers, I can actually reposition them. So they feel really comfortable now. My whole hand, as it were, thanks me. For paying attention to it and relaxing it. And I go back up to my shoulders and my neck now. The neck takes the pressure of the head balanced on top. And if my head is too far forward or too far back, too far to the left or too far to the right, it does create a neck pain and stress. That's not what I want to do in meditation. I want the neck to feel at ease too. So I move my head left, right, back and forward until I can find the best posture for it. Once I have, then I can go to the head itself. And this is where I start to become aware of the feelings around my eyes, around the nose, around the mouth, maybe around the head, or the forehead. To experience those sensations and see if I can relax them. Because I know that your emotions are played out on the muscles of your face, especially some of the negative emotions like anger or fear or anxiety. Your face reconfigures to each one of those emotions. Now I want to relax all those muscles. It's a great way of loosening the grip of especially the negative emotions on you. It also feels nice. I'm relaxing the muscles around my mouth, my nose, my eyes. Nothing is tight anywhere in my face. Or around my nose. And honestly, that feels really pleasant. I look at the whole body sitting here. Now I connect everything up together. It's been relaxed part by part, but I might have missed some parts. So as I scan the whole body, if I can see any part which needs a little bit more attention, a little bit more relaxation, I will happily go there. And then I get to the point where the whole body is just so at ease. I'm not making this up, I'm just describing how it feels to me. And when it's so at ease, again it has the special tingle, a body which is at peace, is contented and is satisfied, the best an old body can do. I enjoy that. And I notice once I perceive the enjoyment of a relaxed body, the relaxation goes deeper. You get more relaxed. This is why I meant relax to the max is a powerful meditation technique. But then this is just relaxing the body, but it prepares it. You have developed a lot of mindfulness and kindness. And the body is at ease. It makes it easy to let it go. How do you let it go? You focus on a quality of the mind called peace. How peaceful are you right now? Just start noticing peace, and usually the peace is quite delightful. By this stage, got nothing much to do with your body. Of course you may have other business to do, but please make sure that you start noticing the peace in this present moment. The future is not peaceful, it has business to do. The past is often not peaceful, because it has the memories which you carry with it. But this present moment is free. It's here you can find peace. And this peace is part of your mind. Peace lives in the mind, not in the body. So now you are becoming aware of your mind. The aspect of the mind called peace. And see if you can notice with your mindfulness what makes the peace more stable and more deep. First of all, you will find the kindness which you give to this present moment. Open the door of your heart to now. Spend a lot of time looking at the past and the future, but now is the opportunity just to be here now. And as you are in this present moment, please learn how to be contented with it, and easily satisfied, not demanding anything out of this present moment, just being happy to be with it. And then hopefully after a few moments, you'll be able to notice how silence, not giving things names, not thinking, but being aware, but not giving it a word to describe it, that inner silence makes the peace more stable and more profound. No need to take notes in your mind by trying to remember things. You will remember automatically afterwards. Just be peaceful. Be silent. And you're getting to understand what being still means. I am going to be quiet for 5 minutes. When I start speaking again, you'll be to sum up the meditation and ring the bell. just being silent and being peaceful. You may be watching your breathing or loving kindness. It's the peace and the silence which are most important. How do you feel? It's good to know the benefits, the peace of meditation as a personal experience. It means so much to you. Now in about a minute, we're going to end the meditation. Just prepare to come out of the meditation. And notice how you feel. And open your eyes. And smile. And the meditation is concluded. Thank you for listening. Okay. Now, I think in the old days, this would be an opportunity for some questions about meditation. Or unless you wanted to give me to give a talk. But Chris, what would you like me to do?
Well, really it's up to you, Ajahn, and we'd be very happy. I can see there's already a question in the chat, which if you would like to start with that one, that would be fine.
Okay. I don't have access, can't see the chat here. So what was the question?
Would you like me to read it for you?
Please, yes.
Can you please ask Ajahn about taking generous time to settle the body for meditation? Is it correct to understand that in taking our time, we are training the mind and generating ease and joy, and that can help us to not run away from the experience? Can a meditation also end up just taking time to settle the body?
Yes. Settling the body is an important part of the meditation practice, and it also does make you more mindful, more kind, because it's a kindness which settles the body. The mindfulness has to be there, but the kindness does the actual work of relaxing everything and making it, it's almost like trusting the body rather than being a control freak. So every time I do this, I look at my body and just, I don't expect everything to be perfect, but if there's some place which is not perfect, I can just focus on it, let it be, and it relaxes. And by taking that time, however long it means to take, then when you actually get to that beautiful relaxation of the body, which I talked about, then it's just so easy to watch the parts of the mind call like peace and silence. It's a great preparation to go deeper into the meditations. Of course, in a half an hour, you know, for a monk it's not a long time to meditate, it's very short. So you get used to relaxing the body, you know, 15-20 minutes. That really establishes your mindfulness and kindness. And then when you go into things like peace and stillness, it really is delightful. Such an easy thing to do. And then as far as the breath comes up, the breath meditation, which a lot of people do, I never go watching the breath. The breath comes to me. So being peaceful, being silent, and then the image of the breath, the feeling of the breath going in and going out, it just comes into my mind. I don't choose to do it. It's just the only thing left which is moving. So it becomes very easy to watch and very comfortable. And so you can watch it for a long period of time. It's delightful. that delight has been established at the beginning. And then the once the delight is established, it's easy to keep focusing on something which you don't choose, you don't hold. It comes to you. It's just like a little bird comes and sits on your shoulder. You don't grab onto it. It just sits there and it's relaxing with you. It's a beautiful experience. That's one of the reasons why the meditation, it is usually very happy, very peaceful, very easy to do, if you know how to do it properly. And sometimes you can meditate for hours. Very simply, just watching the breath gets very, very gorgeous and peaceful and still. And it's a simple thing to do. So anyway, that's actually how we do the meditation. Spend as long as the body needs. Don't be demanding, come on, I haven't got much time, I want to do this quickly. If you haven't got much time, just go a little ways into the body relaxation. If you've got a lot of time, oh, it's just so happy to do. So I enjoyed it, even though I spent a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, just relaxing my body much longer than usual. I still enjoyed doing that. And of course it also gives you the benefit, I know I say too much about this maybe, it gives you the benefit of good health. You get to know your body. You become a friend to your body. And you realize just how to really bring it so much ease that health happens. And it doesn't mean that you're healthy to begin with, you just maintain your health. Even if you happen to be sick, you have got a cancer, you've got an injury or something. It's amazing just how that mindfulness and kindness can help do the impossible, heal things which shouldn't be healed, shrink tumours which aren't supposed to be shrunk. And in all those years I've been doing this and practicing this, you see it happens. It's amazing when it does happen. Some spiritual traditions, they would call that a miracle. It's not a miracle, it's just the nature of the body. It's giving it a hand, relaxing it, so things can actually flow more normally, more easily, and healing happens. Kind of love those stories where someone gets healed. There was one of the best stories some years ago, and many of you know these stories. This guy came into a meditation retreat I was teaching over in Sydney. And the first day of the question time, people were all asking the same question. Can you please ask our meditators to breathe quietly? Because he was breathing so loudly through his mouth, and it was disturbing others. And then I apologized. I said, I should have announced that that man has got a big tumor in his sinuses. His doctors have given up on him, and just this is what he's trying to do to maybe continue his life. He can't breathe through his nose. It's all blocked up with a big tumour. And first of all, when you gave a people in this retreat the explanation why he was making such noise, no one complained anymore. When they understood what he was going through, probably the last weeks of his life, they gave him so much kindness and compassion. It was actually beautiful to behold. He was still noisy, but when people knew where it was coming from, it just reminded them of the beauty of kindness. But of course, that's not the end of the story. The end of the story is much better. The last meditation he did at that 9-day retreat, it always is the last meditation. I don't know why. I think it's because people give up and they let go at last. They relax. But the last meditation, I was getting into the car to go to the airport to fly back to Perth. And he came running after me. He said, don't go yet, I have to tell you this, he said. On that last meditation, he said, he heard a popping sound. I remember that word. He said, my nose went pop and I could breathe through my nose again for the first time in months. He said, but only for a minute and then it blocked up again. This was not an imagination, this was real. His tumour had shrunk. And I just basically imagine if that was you and you think, you know, you're going to die. And it gave him a bit of hope. And of course I had to go, I said, well done, carry on. And honestly, I really did think he'd left it too late to learn meditation. I thought he was, you know, a goner. But then what happened about 3 months or 6 months later, giving a talk in another part of Sydney, this man came up to me and he said, do you remember me, Ajahn Brahm? It's not a sort of a good question to ask, but I don't mind him asking that question. Because he didn't look like that man with cancer. You know when you've got cancer when you're dying? Just, you know, you look really sick. Now this man who came up to me looked really healthy. He was in a nice suit and smiling all over his body. I say over his body, I think that's a good description, because it wasn't just his face was smiling. He looked happy, happy to see me as well. He said, I carried on meditating as you taught me. I'm that man. My cancer is now in full remission. Thank you so much. And now he said, whatever years he's got left of his life, he's going to devote it to teaching meditation. That's just a nice little experience. A man who was a goner, you know, he should be dead. But through that meditation, he managed first of all to get the pop, to actually have this moment when his breath could go through his nose again, and then eventually just the tumour just shrinking totally, that he was in remission. And you know, if just one story like that happens to you, you know, you feel it's amazing. And you just want to share it with everybody, because if it happens to one person, why not many people? Anyway, I can see a quote here. Dear Ajahn, oh, it's gone again.
Okay, Ajahn, there are actually two here. We have one here before that one. I have a problem with sloth and torpor, and also aversion to sloth and torpor.
Yeah.
Please advise if you can.
Yeah. First of all, please let go of the aversion to sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is not the big problem. Restlessness, thinking too much, is a far bigger problem. And there's all these stories, like one of them is where the Buddha, this is one of Buddhist scriptures, the Buddha saw this monk sitting perfectly straight, perfect posture. And the Buddha turned around to his attendant, Ananda, and said, I'm worried about him. And of course that monk eventually disrobed. And then deeper in the forest he saw another monk who was nodding, sloth and torpor, and the Buddha smiled. He said, I'm not worried about him. And soon that sloth and torpor monk became fully enlightened. What is the meaning of that? I've seen this so often in my monastic life. Some monks who are control freaks, and they sit up perfectly straight. They never seem to have sloth and torpor. They've got so much tightness in their mind and in their body. And after a while they can't stand it any longer, they disrobe. I've seen other monks in a mirror, myself, had lots of sloth and torpor when I was a young monk. I tried to fight that, and it didn't work. I got more sloth, more torpor. And what happened was I went to Bangkok to do a visa. And we were, first of all, we had much better food in Bangkok than up in the northeast. We could actually sleep in. We didn't have to get up in the middle of the night when the bell went to go for the morning chanting. And we found a room in this monastery which had an aircon, air conditioned. And I went in there early in the morning, about 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning, had easy meditation. There's no sloth and torpor at all. And I thought, why? And I already gave you the answers. I had sloth and torpor for physical reasons, malnourished, not enough sleep, And I was born in England, in London. I was not used to the hot, steamy, you know, close atmosphere of meditating in the jungle in northeast Thailand. And just, you know, just having that experience, unexpected, of meditating in a place which was cool, good food, and also just no mosquitoes to disturb you, and enough sleep. My meditation took off. So I realized sloth and torpor is often a physical problem. And after a while, be with the sloth and torpor. You have a little bit of mindfulness there, not great mindfulness, but a little bit. Don't fight it, get to know it, make peace with it. And after a while you find, because you don't fight the sloth and torpor, the energy which you'd normally waste by fighting and controlling, the energy starts to return to your body and mind, naturally. It was strange, but you'd start the meditation when I was young, sort of almost bent double. And when I didn't fight it, you'd just notice during the meditation, the energy would come back and the mind would become clear. But it wouldn't become restless, it would just become clear and poised. It's a beautiful meditation state. And I realized doing that for so many years. You know that this was my 48th range retreat as a monk. And I was meditating for about 5 years before that. So I've got a lot of experience in meditation, especially as a monk and as a teacher. Please don't fight the sloth and torpor. Make peace with it. And then you'll find the sloth and torpor just disappears by itself. Basically, the mind wakes up and it's very wonderful and peaceful. Once that sloth and torpor just starts to vanish and you get a mind which is balanced and poised, don't disturb it with restlessness. So if you've got sloth and torpor, that's good. I can relate to you.
Okay. Okay, it's a wonderful answer, Ajahn. Could the metta, karuna, sent to that man by yourself in the retreats,
yes,
once they knew what was happening, have also helped with his healing?
Well, he wasn't a Buddhist before he came, because, you know, he was saying he was just doing this as a last throw of the dice, I think he said. He didn't know too much about loving kindness or compassion or anything. But that was obviously part of the teachings there. And of course that would have helped. First of all, you have to get rid of the fear. Because the fear just makes you so tense you don't allow loving kindness to happen. I think it was probably because, you know, he was desperate. That, you know, he put so much time on the cushion. But it's also because it was the last meditation. And the last meditation on a 9-day retreat, you tend to give up. There's nothing's working. So you take away that tightness of craving and you relax. And that's happened so many times. Again, people think this is just a joke. It's not, there's something very powerful to this. That even the Buddha's chief attendant, Ananda, when the Buddha passed away, Ananda had been accompanying, looking after the Buddha for 25 years. And you'd think that somebody so close to such a great teacher would be getting something, but Ananda wasn't enlightened. When the Buddha passed away, he thought, oh my goodness, I spent so much time, you know, looking after the Buddha, working, that I haven't had enough time to meditate myself. And the Buddha's going to die and I'm not enlightened yet. And after the Buddha passed away, there's lots of work to do. And so he was a go-to monk after the Buddha passed away. But eventually, the senior monks and nuns, the arahats, enlightened beings, decided to meet together to collect all the teachings together. It's called the First Council. And they invited Ananda because he had known so much, been with the Buddha for such a long time. So there were 499 perfectly enlightened beings, and Ananda was the exception. And of course you can understand what it must feel like. Everyone else is enlightened, but not you. So that night he gave it everything he got. He meditated and meditated and meditated. But as the dawn came up, he still wasn't enlightened. He felt very depressed, but he realized he still had maybe an hour before the meeting would start. So he decided to go to his room and take a rest. And as he went to rest, as he lay down, just before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened being. He wasn't trying to get enlightened. He was like the donkey who'd been running after enlightenment all night and now stopped. And then the carrot came towards him. That's how these things happen. They became the 500th enlightened being in the very last meditation. And apparently, according to the tradition, he deliberately arrived late for the meeting. And they locked the door so it couldn't be disturbed. And this monk, just freshly enlightened, made an entrance. He came in through the keyhole. They don't say exactly how he came in through the keyhole, but they said he came in through the keyhole and through a blaze of light, just to make sure that everyone realized that something had happened the night before. And to this day, I call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. You've been meditating and meditating and meditating, getting nowhere. Go to bed. Who knows? Before your head hits the pillow, you may become another enlightened being of the Armadale Meditation Group.
Well, here's hoping, John. And is there anybody who'd like to unmute and ask a question? You're most welcome to unmute and ask a question too.
Gloria.
Gloria would like to speak with John.
Yes, I don't have a question, but I want to share something, which is I had a brother which is 3 years older than me, and he used to be like really angry and had bad temper. And in the past, I used to think that, well, why can't he be kinder or why can't he be better? But after listening to a lot of your talk, I realized that he probably, because we both don't come from a very good family and we don't find acceptance in our life. And then I realized that he had that anger towards everyone and everything because no one accepted him. And I told him that you're good enough. And then I told him that you're good enough. And then I love you, whatever you are, wherever you are. And I also like apologize for things that I've done, and I thank him for the things he done. And then I did everything you told, which is I forgive him when he make me angry. And I help him whenever he needs me, and I'm kind to him all the time. And now he's much more calmer, and like he's a much like better in terms of his temper, and he also start to like find interest in his life. And yeah, I want to say thank you, because last time he told me he wanted to buy a game for me, and I've been really touched.
Yeah.
Not because of the game, but because he remembered that I like the game and he wants to buy it to me. And yeah, I feel really touched, and yeah, so thank you very much.
Very good, that's wonderful. Little things like that. Thank you for telling me, it means a lot to me as well, because you know, you're doing a service. And when you see the results of that service, it may be just one person. You know, it's, you know, someone who's got the same blood as you, or the same sort of offspring of your parents. It's, you can't get rid of them. It's wonderful if that kindness and that type of speech, it just heals them. And I've mentioned to many of you that I spent a lot of time in the young parts of my life going to prisons to teach. And when you go to prisons to teach, there you see, I'm not saying your brother's a criminal, but saying people like that, they've been hurt so much in their life, and now they're in these jails. And when they're looked down upon, they are no respect. And if you can go in there to some monk or visitor or somebody and just give them some kindness, just the way they respond is just amazing. These are people who have been put in jail for really terrible things. And they think they'll never get respect. But you give them a little bit, give them the seed, and it grows. There's one guy who comes to mind. I mention him at almost every retreat which I teach, because we had, at the beginning times, difficulty getting a cook to do the meals for all the meditators. And there's 60 people meditating, and the monk as well. There's a lot of work. We managed to get this guy. His name was Carl, and he was an amazing cook. And he came early in the morning, and he just cooked some incredible food all by himself. He just put so much effort and energy into this. And at the end of the retreat, when people was wanting to say thank you to him for all his kindness and hard work, and they asked me, where is he? And I told everybody, I didn't tell you at the beginning, but that man was on, you had to arrange it through the prison officers. He was on leave. Not leave, actually, just doing some, I forget what they called him. Anyway, he was a prisoner at Karna Prison Farm, which is close to Jhana Grove. And we got permission for him to come every morning to cook for each one of you. And in the evening, he'd go back to prison again. First of 9 days. So that's where he is now. He's back in jail, because he was just only allowed out during the daytime. And I said, no, he is in jail for rape. A couple of times. And when they heard that, just like you, people were shocked. Ajahn Brahm, you let someone who'd raped come and cook for us. I said, yes. I wanted to tell you that someone who's raped is not a rapist. Someone who's committed a crime is not a criminal. Someone who has stolen is not a thief. They're a person who's done some thieving. But they're much bigger than that. And you saw that in this man called Carl. I had no doubt at all that he would do such a wonderful job when he was given that trust and given that chance. And of course, eventually he was released. Now he's married, and I'm not quite sure where he's living now, because he said he's just built himself a house in the Philippines with his wife. A wonderful man, totally trustworthy. You give him a chance, which a lot of people wouldn't, and he took that chance. And he will never do any crime like that ever again. And so that's one of the reasons why you can always see something beautiful and kind in every human being. And you give them that recognition, you say something kind to your brother, and it opens him up and he grows so beautifully. He's only just started growing. He's shown so much more wonderful things in his life. So well done. So be careful when you come on one of my retreats. You don't know who's doing the cooking. He's a really good food man, he's a good friend.
Food for thought, Ajahn.
Yeah, food for thought, yeah.
Is there anybody else who would like to get a last question in before we finish the evening?
Is that Martha?
Martha, would you like to unmute? Or did you want to ask something else or make a comment?
No, you answered mine earlier about sloth and torpor.
Oh, okay.
I'm fighting it real badly. I have a serious aversion to it. And and then I end up doing what you said, which is try to counteract it with restlessness.
Yeah.
And that does not work. No. Then I end up in bad habits.
Yeah.
Real bad habits.
Yeah. So please be kind to your sloth and torpor, given it such a hard time, poor thing. So... And after a while, it just disappears by itself when you don't fight it. is come to teach you something. In Thailand, I hated, I must admit, I'm being honest, hated the mosquitoes. They were just really sadistic. They just wouldn't bite you. They come into your ear first of all, buzz, 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 we're coming for you, buzz, 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 and then they bite you. And so when I told Ajahn Chah that, I said, can you help? This is driving me crazy, all these mosquitoes. And he said, from now on, you must call those mosquitoes Ajahn mosquitoes. They're your teacher from now on. And I thought it was crazy, but it meant so much to have those as your teacher. You learned so much from them. And then he was right. Your sloth and torpor is your teacher. So you're going to learn so much from it. And once you've learned their lesson, then you don't have them come visit you anymore. Then you're free.
Will it go away? Will it go away? Will it go away?
Of course it will.
Will it go away? Will it go away?
Yeah. Once you've learned their lesson. And then they go away.
Thank you.
Okay. What was money back guarantee? I like giving money back guarantees because he didn't pay any money.
Well, thank you for that, Ajahn. Ajahn, would you like to finish our evening by offering us a blessing?
Oh, yeah, sure. Medium, short, or long?
Long.
Okay, here's a nice blessing for you all. Sabaroga Winimuto Sabasanta Powajito Sabawera Mati Gando Nibuto Chatuang Bawa Sabitio Wiwa Chantu Sabarogo Vina satu mate bhavan vantarayo sukhi digayu gopava apivadanha silitsa nichang vuta pachalino chataro dhamma vatanti Ayuvano Sukhang Balang. Very good.
And thank you, Ajahn. And thank you, everyone, for being here this evening. Your presence is indeed a present to us all. Our program is now finished, and we hope you will join us again next week. And looking forward to seeing you next week. And Ajahn, thank you for a most special evening, as always.
My pleasure. See you. Bye. Bye.
Bye. All the best.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Yeah, good night.
See ya.
Thank you, Ajahn. Thank you,
everyone. Very good. Don't do anything I wouldn't
thank
do.
Thank you.
See ya.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Jen. Okay.
And thank you.
Really.
Very good, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
When do you fly off, John?
Yeah, no trouble.
She said, when do you fly off? I think.
When do I fly off? Not tonight. Live in the present moment.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn.
See ya.
Okay.
Thank you for that.